Hello, welcome to Sound Thinking. I'm Marty Duda. It's a new podcast that, I'm over at the 13th floor. We have a panel of experts, so to speak, music journalists from around the country who are going to bring us the latest on four new releases this week. Over here is Jamila. Hi, Jamila. Jamila Ross-Hayes.
Hey.
You're going to talk about what?
I'm going to talk about Aliza McLam's new album.
Very good. And then down in... We also have Graham Reed. He's over at Elsewhere. And Graham, what are you going to bring us today?
I'm going to talk about the new album by Shed Seven, a British Britpop band who's still around.
Still around. And finally, we have Andra Jenkin, who's going to tell us all about Sleater-Kinney. How you doing, Andra?
I'm great, thanks.
And you do a bit of comedy, some singing and dancing and writing and singing as well, right?
Yeah, I've been in various bands forever ago, doing stand-up comedy at the moment, and I do a bit of writing for a couple of comedy shows.
Great. And we should mention that Jamila's in Marmalade, a current band that we catch from every once in a while, and used to host the Uptown Lowdown on the 13th floor. So that's who we all are. And so we got four albums that we're going to cover today. Now, Andra has a new album, probably by the most well-known band of the bunch, other than if you're in the UK and Graham's guys, but Sleater-Kinney has a new album out, which is always an event. What have you got to tell us about it there?
Well, Sleater-Kinney have been around for 30 years, but they had an eight-year hiatus in the middle. Kind of came out of riot girl bands, feminist. I kind of hate that I have to, that it's still remarkable to say that it's an all-girl band or all-woman band, but it is remarkable still, you know. No one bats an eyelid if there's a bunch of dudes in a band, but when it's all women, it's worthy of note, sadly. I started out kind of wondering what I was listening to. There was such an eclectic feel and genre transgression. There's this quiet, loud and lean sound. Everything sort of drops away and is pared down, and then you get this aggressive rock sound and punk beats that kind of leave you disoriented and confused. And then when I looked at more of the bio stuff, I saw that Little Rope is the name of the album, is forged by grief after Carrie's mother, Carrie Brownstein, who's a founding member, her mother and stepfather were killed in a car collision. And it starts to make sense. You know, the album itself has all the elements of a collision, and we're somehow involved, you know, like there's this raw anger and confusion and frustration. And the videos themselves, they're like these twisted dream sequences, and like grief, the lyrics kind of turn and twist on you, and sound comes and goes in waves, and it's either isolating or overwhelming. You can't trust the mood, which can boil into anger or drop away into despair at any moment. It feels really unreal and unstable. But at the same time, it's clear that Corin Tucker, the singer, and Brownstein know each other well and have worked on songs together for decades, you know. That they've recently lost a 2019 drummer, Janet Weiss, not the Janet Weiss from Rocky Horror, just another drummer. She has this kind of light, complex touch that I think will...
Damn it, Janet.
That's right. Will sorely be missed. Like, they're really coy about who played drums on the album. Angie Boylan is doing the live touring, but the drumming on the album is a simpler style than Weiss's, but not because the drummer isn't capable of complexity or experimentation, but that raw and vulnerable feel of the album itself requires a more simple beat at times, where it's kind of a leaner sound is more effective at realizing and revealing emotional damage, which, I mean, the whole album is really about emotion. I thought when I was listening to all of the albums, that was something that they all had in common. You know, I looked at Amanda Palmer as well, and Aliza McLam. There's all this, like, the emotions are really on the surface and they're kind of highlighted. The mood belies like a trapped restraint. There's like an aggressive anger, but a fear of a future less controlled emotional explosion is possible. But then it's kind of raw and vital. It's really punky and really new wave. That they've sort of thrown everything in the kitchen sink at it in terms of genre. You know, you've got pop elements and rock elements and alt rock and But that also speaks of someone who's been going 30 years and has really experienced musicians that can draw on all of their experiences. the number one song on it is Hell. And you sort of expect like a banger straight out of the box for your first, you know, your first one's usually a ripper. And so it was surprised to hear this sort of slow, desperate refrain that was this departure that sort of almost sounded like the opening theme song in a Western film, but then it develops into this eclectic punk pop song with electronica, and it's a tricky sound to quantify. Like, it's like they don't want to be pinned down to a single genre, and they're just kind of using every tool at their disposal to express this incredible grief and pain that you can feel the pain being processed. You know, I think Eliza McLam almost floats above her pain, and Amanda Palmer is going through it at the time, whereas this smacks of something that's hard to focus on because the pain is still to come. It's like it's still being processed. If we can have a listen to Hell, you'll see what I mean.
Hell don't have no worries. Hell don't have no past. Hell is just a signpost when you take a certain path. Hell needs no invitation. Hell don't make no fronts. Hell is desperation. And
they go into the chorus, it's like this really fast-paced, rocky, distorted, atonal guitar. So they go from that really pared-down verse to like a more full-on chorus, and it smacks to me of someone who doesn't care what the audience is going to receive at the other end. It's not about making marketable music. Mm. It's about processing, and, you know, she was talking about the physical act of playing guitar grounding her to life, like something tangible that she could touch while she was going through these crazy emotions. Whereas Needlessly Wild, the second track, is like this danceable, a little boppy, you know, classic punk vocal gimmicks over bass at rock beats, like aggressively fun as per the lyrics, you know. And there's like, it's really hooky and new wave 80s. It's got this urgency. Like, I can hear the influence of Blondie and Ripper to Shreds in there. If you want to check out Needlessly Wild. Videos too, because they are really kind of put forward as a feminist band, and I can tell like they've got an older woman singing in one of them, and she's just kind of miming the words, like a deliberate deliberately not using conventionally attractive young things. Yeah, there's just, it's only a feminist would choose this as a video, you know what I mean? Like it's up front and center about liberal politics, and I can see there's probably a protesting stuff will be in there if I looked at there over, you know, like there's some really interesting drumming, particularly like in Hunt You Down. They're all rim shots, no snare, no kick to start, and sometimes they're barely there. There's a lot of, you know, in small fines there's atonal guitar with distorted bass and really complex drums, you know, and so that there's these flourishes and trills in the voice often found in punk or new wave, and quirky note bending harmonies, and it, like, so it's got this really experimental feel as well. Like, you never know what you're going to get. You've like, there's this interesting openings and don't feel right, and you know, these fast paced drums that don't have time to reverberate before being struck again, like it's almost a tambourine effect, and back to basic for verses. So it's you know, there's a punky slits feel to it, and it's again, like, there's confessional poetry elements where there's this list of unapologetically women's concerns, where it's not about, you know, big dumb rock and roll, and it's got this more reflective quality. So yeah, I got a lot of it out of it. Any song that you listen to will be very different to the next. You can see why it's all on the same album, but Six Mistakes is like really heavy drums, a lot of bass. It's really aggressive, a lot of kick and tom-tom, and it's got like this punk vocals and fast pace and use of lo-fi and things. So it's, yeah, it was really hard to pin down because it was so eclectic. But once you understand it through the lens of grief, you understand the grief is being unwrapped in it.
I've been a bit of a fan of these people since forever. And when this came out, you know, I was onto it straight away, just listening yesterday and thought, oh, yeah, this is the album that I was hoping for, wanting from them. And it wasn't until I looked back, I realized I actually missed their last one, The Path of Wellness. I don't know why, but that went straight past me. And I'd love No Cities to Love and The Cedar Won't Hold. I just thought they were absolutely fantastic albums. So this has prompted me to go back to this one. And I got to say, Andrew, I really like the fact that you mentioned Wave a few times there, because, you know, when I hear you say it like you mean it, it's just that this junction of power pop and alt rock and a kind of desperate new wave. And they all these genres just seem to implode and something unique comes out of it. And it's uniquely Sleeping Beauty, I think.
Jamila, any thoughts?
I initially just was kind of like, not in a bad way, but kind of overwhelmed by it. Like it's such high energy. It's really emotional. It's quite like intense and fast paced. But then I read the description that talks about, I feel like you articulated it so well, Andrew, about grief and how, you know, the writing is done as you're sort of processing pain. And I think it really does make it make sense. And I think that's what stood out to me the most, is the combination of the music with the story and the meaning behind it. I think that without the understanding of that, like the understanding of that makes it better. I don't know, it adds to it, and those two things combined make what makes it beautiful. It's the isolated things. The music isolated on its own, like, isn't done as much justice as with the story behind it, I think.
In Untidy Creature, when I looked at the music video, there's these long, sustained notes that overpower the vocals, and it literally drowns them out. And then the image is of a woman in a bath underwater, and she's not breathing the whole time. Like, it's one long, sustained shot that builds the tension because she's clearly hasn't got any air left in her, and it's an uncomfortable feeling, you know, and there was like these deep breaths, and you know, the lyrics are like holding pieces so tight, so it gives you that sense of that you get when you're in grief or you're in pain, of that tight chest and feeling like you're drowning, which I, you know, the imagery and the music really work together there in Untidy Creature.
I thought it's interesting that I believe it's Corin Tucker who's doing all the vocals this time, because Harry Brownstein, who probably wrote most of the songs and had the dealing with the accident and all that, probably couldn't feel that she could actually do that. So another element to this particular album as opposed to the other one. So, yep, interesting record. We got some good stuff this week. So we're going to throw Graham into the deep end with his overview of the new one from Shed 7.
Well, the album I'm going to talk about is by a band that I know not many people in this country are aware of, but were very, very big in Britain for a long time, and it was my good fortune to see them there. And the band is called Shed 7, and the album Matter of Time, which we will come to in a moment. But the question is, you know, why should I be interested in a band from the Britpop era, which nobody else here even bothered with at the time? Well, it just so happened that I was in and out of the UK at the time, you know, so weeks at a time, and I saw a lot of the Britpop bands. You know, Oasis played a really great small gig about a week after Wembley. And I saw lots of these bands, Ocean Colour Scene, people like that. And there was this side, you know, behind the Blurs and the Pulps and, you know, the Oasis bands, there was this other tier of groups. And Shed 7 was one of those. And for reasons which I can't begin to explain, about 1996, I went to see Shed 7 play at a gig in London. They were on the back of their second album called A Maximum High. And this album had really caught the imagination of people. It did very, very well for them. I interviewed their singer, Rick Witter, before the show, and he was a really smart guy. I liked him a lot. He had that kind of, I don't know, you know, sort of cocky British arrogance, not just cocky in a Britpop sense, but more akin to somebody like John Lennon had in the 1960s, just so self-assured, just knowing. I liked him very much, and I thought, well, this will be interesting. To be honest, I didn't know a hell of a lot about them. I just knew they were part of that whole scene. And when I saw them play this gig, which was in a venue maybe, oh, I don't know, twice the size of the power station, possibly a bit bigger, it was just extraordinary. They just went off. And the thing that impressed me is that it seemed like everybody in the audience knew every single word of every single song. And so I realized then and there, wow, you know, this is a band. This is a band that's got some, you know, real legs and pedigree. And the Maximum High, as I say, their biggest album, was their second album. So they'd done a bit of groundwork. And at the time they were, Maximum High was very much in that sort of Brit pop vein. Unfortunately, what happened after that is that I, as I say, I did this interview with Rick Witter, liked him very much, loved the show, came back to New Zealand and thought, oh man, this is going to be great, I'll write this up for the Herald and give these guys the massive coverage they clearly deserve. And nobody in this country had heard of them. They just never made a ripple in the cosmos here. And so that interview was never written up, and I can't even remember the content of it at all. And I just kind of thought, oh, that's disappointing, because had they toured here at that time, I think something would have happened. And that happens a lot with those British bands. You know, we click on some of them, like Gomez, for example. You know, Gomez, they're quite, when they came here, they pulled big crowds. But it never really happened for Shed 7 in this country. And I think probably we just sort of lumped them in with, oh, yeah, all those Britpop bands, particularly the second tier ones. They didn't have much going for them, unlike, you know, Elastica or Pulp or whatever. They didn't have a sort of distinguishing feature, but they were just a very, very good, I'd say great, live band. Unfortunately, after that, their next album called Let It Ride was commercially disappointing. The record company dropped them. There were some lineup changes. The co-founder, Paul Banks, quit. And then that was it. They did a kind of farewell tour in the early 2000s. Then in 2017, they did, a very good album called Instant Pleasures. They reformed. But, you know, you could very easily say, oh, well, okay, let's tick all these boxes. And I think I said that. I think I said boxes ticked for sure in what I wrote for my website elsewhere. And the boxes would have been, you know, Oasis, English Pop, Stadium Pleasers, the big ballad, widescreen guitar, all of that sort of stuff. But again, I just thought, but these guys are good. And so that's why I've just chosen this one, pulled out of the pack, as it were. I'm not going to say that this is an absolutely stunningly brilliant album. Again, it is boxes ticked. But the album is called A Matter of Time. It's produced by Youth, who was behind the desk for Instant Pleasures. And no, it doesn't shift the dial all that much from that formula that worked on a Maximum High and this previous one, Instant Pleasures. So I'm going to start with just the opening track. It's just got this big wheel spinning guitar driving it, and appropriately it's called
Okay, so that was Let's Go from Shed 7 that Graham's talking about. I got to say, I'm just going to interject. That's the first track on the album. When I heard that, I was completely turned off by this album. And then when I went back to listen to the whole thing, I loved the rest of it. I just hated that song. They sound like a kind of immature punk band of generic things, but the rest of it is great. You know, the Britpop thing is happening and the rest of it, but not on that song.
You know, it's a bratty sort of punk kind of version of Britpop. But the album gets more interesting after that. And I would accept that if anybody heard that, they might just say, well, I don't know, it doesn't do it for me. Yeah. It's all too familiar. But it just does get better. And the second track I find very interesting because this is something that these guys moved towards after they broke up and then reformed. In the Reformation era, they gravitated to something more akin to, I don't know, American power pop as much as what we might call recognizable Britpop tropes. So this track called Kissing California has some of those elements going on. It is British, but it's got that kind of, I don't know, West Coast jangle rock thing going on. And that's the second track of the album. And after that, as I say, it just kind of goes on and builds. So this is the second track from the album by Shed 7 called Matter of Time. This is Kissing California. What would you do if I called for you? You'd wrap your arms around California. Every day my love grows for you. Okay, so I'm going to admit that on this album there are tracks that are, as we might say, surplus to requirements. But, you know, they really do manage to nail some of the energy that was there in that period of Oasis. Supergrass also, I think you would name check Supergrass. There's really a really good track called Let's Go Dancing. And I would say that some people might hear the Smiths at their most energetic in some of what they do. But right towards the end, there is the track called Throwaways, and it's the big finish. It's got Pete Doherty, and it just kind of sums up something. When you think about their album titles, A Maximum High, ironically, was their big album way back in the, I think it was 96 came out. Well, at the end of this album, which, you know, as we've said, is a, you know, the title is telling a matter of time. At the very end of it is Throwaways. And the lyrics in part go like this. We were born on a rising tide, only to realize we're only looking from the outside. Only to find we're not part of the crowd, but we'll keep rising slowly. We won't change our ways, even if that means we're thrown away. Now, ironically, Throwaways at the end of this album, this album went to number one on the UK indie charts. 30 years after these guys came out of York, they finally got their number one independent chart, admittedly, not the mainstream charts, but the independent one. And so there it is. You know, we had a maximum high, which was their maximum high, and now we've got a matter of time, and it has been a matter of time, but they're back. And I like this album. I like it for what it is. It is simple, guitar-driven, masculine. Let's be honest, it's just masculine rock and roll. But it's not that archetypal Britpop. It's got these other things going on. It's got this American... Something about America has filtered in there. So I just thought we could finish with Shed 7. And as I said right at the outset, not a lot of people know these guys. But this is Shed 7, and this is called Throwaways from their this new album, literally just come out, called A Matter of Time.
We were born on a rising tide, only to realize we're only looking from outside.
All right, thanks, Graham. So that's music from Shed 7. I had never heard of the band ever. And like you said, it's been around 30 years. And I like a bit of my Britpop. I thought I knew all about it, but you never know everything. And after I got past that first track, I quite enjoyed the record. So I can see how it could be number one. Jamila or Andra, do you have anything to say about it at all?
I thought it was like pretty fun and upbeat. I've never heard of them before either, but I really can imagine it's something that you would like live. Like, it sounds like something that would really go off live. So I can see why, Graham, after seeing them live, that would sort of like grab you and make you interested in them. Some of the harmonies kind of remind me of like the Beach Boys a little bit, which is kind of cool. I feel like they've got this, like they've got some sort of these sort of classic elements to their sound, and but it's also quite modern in some sense as well. So yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I thought Kissing California reminded me of Mamas and Papas, but that's just me.
It reminded me, I was sort of thinking like Brit Pop goes to California and ends up surfing, you know, like it's got those happy overtones that didn't remind me of Supergrass as well. But yeah, I could definitely hear that sort of laid back surfer quality with the harmonies and things in there.
So Jamila, what have you got for us today? You've got a new artist, Eliza McLam, is that right?
Yeah, now that I've said her name out loud, I'm questioning whether it's Eliza. I'm not sure. But she's got a new album called Going Through It. She's a singer-songwriter from North Carolina who I think sort of started making music on TikTok. And after, you know, people were loving it and wanting more, started releasing music online, which is a story that happens more often these days. You know, a lot of people start writing on TikTok and can get really big from it. Her new album, Going Through It, is made up of 12 songs, four of which were released previously as a single, which is more like an EP in my eyes. It's four songs, titled 16 after one of the tracks. But on Spotify, it's titled as a single, which is interesting. I know people have released double singles before, but I think this is the first time that I've sort of seen more than two tracks released as a single.
Right.
Those four tracks are also on the album, but, you know, there's a lot more there as well. In essence, I think I was trying to think of the way to describe it because it doesn't fit directly in one genre. And the way that I would describe it is thoughtful indie girl pop.
Right.
It's sort of got really descriptive imagery and like honest lyrics that sort of tell it how it is in kind of a straight up way, but also it's really vulnerable and poetic as well. It's quite emotive, and I really think that the whole album kind of tells the stories of growing up and the ups and downs of your 20s, which makes sense as the title is going through it. You know, you're just going through life and dealing with everything that sort of gets thrown at you. both the production and the writing kind of feel quite timely. I guess it's kind of hard to use a word like contemporary, because what does that even mean? But it, you can sort of tell in a sense that she would be liked on TikTok, and it makes a lot of sense that she found her sort of fame on TikTok, I guess. I think it's really hard to describe to people, and I find it difficult to sometimes describe this writing style to people, but it's kind of like a way of talking about mundane or everyday actions, but in a way that reflects deeper meaning. It's kind of drawing comparisons between simple things and bigger feelings. For example, there's some lyrics in her song Cry Baby, which we can play a little bit of, holding funerals for roadkill in the backyard. And then it goes on to say, I was never good at letting things go unattended. And to me, that's just such a beautiful way of, you know, you're speaking about something that's so sort of simple and like an actionable task that everybody can imagine. But somehow just the simpleness of holding a funeral for like a dead animal in your backyard has been drawn to have such deeper meaning. And you can all kind of imagine what that feels like as a kid. It sort of takes you right back to that nostalgia and those feelings. And maybe we can play a little bit of Cry Baby. That was a bit of Cry Baby. I really like that she talks about topics that are a little bit more in depth and kind of things that people don't really talk about. She brushes over anorexia in some of her songs and sort of briefly mentions mental health and things like suicide, but kind of in a way that's not like too overwhelming or too confronting, but just sort of reminding. And I think that when this is done like creatively and delicately, it can kind of create a sense of relatability for people without feeling like it's triggering or like it's something someone's just like divulging onto you. Kind of feels like as an audience of, I imagine a lot of young people sort of listening to these things and kind of going, oh, sort of subtly somewhere in the back of your brain that someone is talking about these things. And if someone that you admire, especially like an artist, is mentioning that they've gone through these things, it can make you feel a little bit more okay about it. And like, maybe you can have discussions about it in your life. The next song I was going to talk about is Glitter. And I think sometimes if you haven't heard of an artist before, as I'm sure many people haven't heard of Aliza because she's quite new, sometimes it helps to draw comparisons to other things that we might listen to, so we can sort of like figure out whether we'd like it or not. In this song Glitter, I really think there's quite a strong like Olivia Rodrigo teen sass energy, which is like Olivia Rodrigo is really popular right now. And it's so interesting how when an artist becomes popular, you notice that a lot of other artists will subtly kind of like come up with similar sounds in their music. In the chorus, there's lyrics, I want to kill your boyfriend. And the way that it's even sung and said is just so teen sass. And it just really gives that vibe and that energy that if you like Olivia Rodrigo, if you're someone that likes her music, I do think that you will like this album. But as well, in some of the other songs, there's quite an undertone of a lot of other artists. It's interesting because, you know, one thing is not exactly like another. I feel like she fits in well with slightly sort of a Lizzie McAlpine influence, maybe a little bit of Taylor Swift, a little bit of Orla Gartland, even a little bit of the Beths influence, which I really notice in the instrumentation of Mythologize Me, if you want to play a little bit of that, Marty.
Okay, I will.
Just a boring anorexic brain.
Yeah, I just think it's kind of hard to sometimes articulate why an artist sounds like another artist. But there's just something about like the big chorus, the really tight second verse with the kind of like spoken
definitely
style
of
lyrics.
Next thing happening, and I think you're right on there. Absolutely. Now I got to ask you this, guys. If it was a guy singing about I Want to Kill Your Boyfriend, would that go over so well as a young lady with a much different voice getting away with it? Because she sounds perfectly harmless when she sings that. But I'm just curious how the rest of you feel about that.
I don't know if she sounds harmless. I think that it's the context is everything. And to me, the overall,
right.
like the, most of the songs had a much, you know, the darker tone. It was these hopeful harmonies and this very sweet voice, almost overly saccharine with these layered lyrics. And it was all kind of clean and ethereal with a lot of reverb. But the content, the messages were all kind of this darker stuff. You know, there's I Want to Kill Your Boyfriend. To me, smacks of her friends going through domestic violence, and she's talking about subject matter like self-harm and abuse, and but is really self-aware and reflective about it when she talks about, you know, it being marketable. A pretty girl with dark problems is really marketable now, and it gives her that edge that and it was consistent all the way through these languid sort of guitar songs, and you know, she gives you that warning. I think I really sort of saw it in Mythologize Me, You Won't Want Me When I'm Better. That I really like that idea that what is marketable about her and what is desirable to all these people is that they can be predatory with her because she's abused, because she's got this darkness in her and because she's got this darkness around her.
I was just going to ask, first of all, Andrew, you found it sort of cynical at all in any way, what she's saying? And then I just asked Jamila, where did you find this artist? How did you come upon it? So my question is two questions.
Do you want to go first?
Sorry, I found it cynical and sarcastic, and it was like, there's a growing up too early, especially in songs like 16, when she's talking about, it sounds like she's talking about her mother having mental illness and she's not letting her out of an institution. And it smacks of someone who grew up really early and knew more about the world than they perhaps should have as a child, and kind of has taken that into adulthood. And I mean, to me, that floaty, there's always a monotone to some of the vocals that reminds me of Mood Stabilizers. Like, she's in that almost hallucinatory, floaty space that mental illness provides when you're on medication. And so it's like, yeah, there's the steady, slow-paced, tranquil, saccharine-sounding vocals, but is that because it's almost a hit, but the message is disturbing and stressful, so is this kind of a medicated song almost?
You mentioned Jamila, she sounds very self-aware. There's a song called Punch Drunk where she's singing, I'm not as careless as I say I am. And obviously she's thinking it simultaneously about her own present, the way she comes across and the way she wants to present herself and all that. So, yeah, anyway, I love the lyrics in this.
Yeah, I'm a real lyric fanatic. I love lyrics. It's something that instantly will draw me to a song, especially when it's done in a way that's, so I don't know, the way that she writes is kind of something that if one of my friends who knew me well and my music taste well would listen to and be like, oh, you would like this because of the way that she writes lyrics. I actually found her, to answer your question, Graham, like just through Marty's email, but I had heard of her music before. I do listen to a lot of artists like Lizzie McAlpine, which is kind of like in a similar realm. So she is someone who I would listen to like outside of reviewing this, and we'll continue to listen to. I just wanted to talk about 16 for a bit, as you mentioned, Andra. It's so heartbreaking. It's such a simple, like stripped back song. The lyrics are so intentional and kind of like there's a thick layer of emotion beneath them, but it's almost like not presented in an overly emotional way. But it's like, the way that she speaks in the song is so delicate, and the production of the song makes space for what she has to say. I think I saw one comment on her Instagram that was like, oh my God, I listened to this on the way to work, and like, now I can't go into work because I'm crying. And I think that, yeah, we can take a listen. I think sometimes when like women in music are kind of presented often in this like light, fluffy, ethereal way. And it's kind of hard sometimes, I think, for people to talk about things in a serious way, with balancing that line of being too serious so that people don't get frightened by it. And also by being serious enough that you're taken seriously. And I think that's like an interesting thing to navigate, especially in this world of like TikTok, and being an artist that's discovered on TikTok, I feel like it's kind of like meeting your partner on Tinder, you know, like people kind of immediately go like, like that's not that serious, you know, and it like sometimes I feel like decreases the validity of an artist from the external eye. But in essence, it's just another platform where you're sharing music, and clearly people, there's something that captures people. If they're hearing like a 15 second clip and they're like, oh my gosh, I need this in my life. Like, can you release the whole version? And I do think there's something beautiful in this. I think I'll like wrap up by saying that like Aliza is not just an artist. Her lyrics really focus a lot on girlhood and identity and growing up. And I was so unsurprising in a way to find that she also co-hosts a podcast called Bitchtopia, which assesses, I'm just reading off, you know, quotes, assesses lowbrow cultural fixations with a highbrow vocabulary. And then, you know, it's feminist, but as stated by her co-host in a New York Times article, we don't want to be like, we're the trailblazers of whatever wave feminist movement. It's just like, yeah, obviously we're feminists. Everybody should be a feminist. It's not something radical to label yourself as, which I think it's so, that is like completely isolated from the music that she creates. But I feel like that adds a, you know, it makes it make sense. So she's not just talking about these topics and standing for this stuff in her music. That's actually her as a person and her work outside of music. So it makes sense where she gets that, some of that inspiration from. And this podcast is really popular. They're making money off it through Patreon, paying themselves and paying other people to work for them. And they've amassed more than 40,000 weekly listeners and roughly 8,000 paid Patreon subscribers, which is pretty awesome.
Crikey. All right. I didn't know that. That's excellent. Almost like Amanda Palmer with her Patreon.
Yeah.
Yes.
I saw that there was a real tradition of confessional poetry in there too, like the idea of the mundanity of sort of domestic, like almost like women's issues, but it's overlaid with this raw and kind of very blunt demand to be heard over, you know, what's going on in the background, that kind of the litany of psychological horrors that's juxtaposed with the sort of casual narration of the mundane. You know, I really like that, you know, a la Anne Sexton or Sylvia Plath, you know, there's that desperation that you find in Sylvia Plath that is really about kind of, you can be very isolated and very, you know, people can think you're this, you know, happy, magical pixie girl, but there's something darker going on beneath the surface that's kind of rising up and bubbling through and demanding to be heard. That's pretty, but pretty disturbing.
It's a good description.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you so much for this. I never heard of this woman, and I think she's quite remarkable from the little that I've heard. And to hear her, you know, used in the same sentence as Sylvia Plath and Sexton makes me, well, you know, I've missed out on something pretty big here. So, yeah, thank you for that. I'm going to I'll forget her stuff. Tell me this, Jamila. You find it cathartic, for her to have done this?
I imagine so. I think sometimes, as an artist myself, I know that writing lyrics can sometimes mean that you're talking about something that you might not have even fathomed was a feeling in yourself before you start writing a song. If the songs are true to her and true to her story, which is something that I, you know, which I imagine they are in their emotionality, it sounds like she's been through some pretty tough stuff. And talking about some of that stuff in a really upfront way could be quite challenging, I imagine. But sometimes writing things and being creative means that you can put those thoughts and feelings into words into like a completely different way. And not only is that cathartic for you in the sense that you're like releasing that emotion, it can also help make sense of those feelings, I think. Sometimes you write a song and you look back on the lyrics and you're like, oh, that's how I'm feeling. Okay. And it can almost be softly confronting in the sense that you can then see how you feel about something. Because I do think that to some degree, when you're writing a song that's quite emotional and unintentional, it's kind of coming from somewhere inside you. That's not your brain. It's kind of coming with, you might not have even thought about that before, and it sort of just comes out and then you can reflect on that. Yeah, I hope she's doing okay as well.
Yes, sounds like it. I haven't heard that. But yes, yeah. No, thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Okay, now I'm going to talk about a band called Sprints, who I'd never heard of until the day before. The record came out, I think, January 5th, the first Friday of the year. And their single, which is called Heavy, was released the day before, and I got an email about it or a press release, and that's how I discovered it. And I know, Graham, you did a little review and write-up. How did you find out about them? Did you know about them before?
No, I'm damned if I could remember. Maybe the same way as you. Maybe you got an email.
Yeah. Because it turns out the band, so the band's from Dublin, Ireland, and they've been around since 2019. And they've been doing the usual thing where you just release a bunch of singles and EPs and finally work up to this first album, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years later after you formed. They got signed by City Slang, and that kind of inspired them to actually think about making a cohesive record, which is called Letter to Self, which, like I said, was just released earlier this year. So, and I love the fact that the way that you react to records depends a lot on your own mental being at the time. Like, for instance, Graham, with Shed 7, when I first heard it, didn't want to hear it again, but then I loved it because I was in a different, with this guy. So this, I heard this just after Christmas, which I had a crappy Christmas, had a boring New Year, and then like the first new record was this Sprints album, and it just, like you guys used the word cathartic, this sounded like the perfect thing that I needed to hear at that time. And so I heard the Heavy song, which I think we'll start with. We'll play that because that's the first thing I heard. Then we'll get into the record in a little bit. So this is Heavy from Sprints.
A simple idea, I'm gonna make it stick. I wanna say this fast, I wanna do this quick. Goes 1, 2, 3, goes 1, 2, 3. I got a simple idea, I'm gonna make it stick. I wanna say this fast, I wanna do this quick. Goes 1, 2, 3, goes 1, 2, 3. Do you ever feel like the room is heavy? Do you ever feel like the room is heavy? Do you ever feel like the room is heavy? Do you ever feel like the room is heavy? Like the air is hot and the air is sweaty? Do you ever feel like the room is heavy? Can I catch it?
All right, so that was Heavy from Sprints, the single that just was released day before the album was out. And like I said, it felt very cathartic, the right thing at the right time, at the right place. So I was loving it. And when I heard that, the band that I thought of immediately was a band called Savages, which I hadn't heard from in a while. And then I read the press release that came along with it. And apparently the way the band was formed was, quote unquote, they had a quote light bulb moment at a Savages gig. So I was like, yay, it all makes sense now. So yeah, so they were formed like I said, in 2019. So the lead singer is a person named Carla Chubb, who also plays some guitar, and I think she writes all the songs. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, when I first hear somebody, the voice, if the voice connects, then that's half the battle, more than half the battle right there, which is why some people love Bob Dylan or Neil Young and some people can't stand them, because the voice hasn't made that connection. And with her, it was immediate. It was like, oh, I think I know where this is coming from, and I can relate to it on certain levels. I mean, I'm quite a bit older than her, and I'm not a female person, but that doesn't seem to matter. You know, I could hear some Patti Smith in there, so that always makes me feel good. And some Bauhaus, there's that post-punk thing going on in the whole thing, and it's just ticking all of my boxes, as you would say, Graham. So I love the thing. So the album came out the following day, and it starts with another tune called Ticking. And I love the way that it just kind of builds this intensity. Like, it doesn't shoot its wad all at one time. You know, it kind of, it's almost spoken sung. There's a great bass line rumbling through, and then the band just breaks loose and just rocks out at the end. So I'll play a little bit of Ticking.
Because there's ticking and there's ringing in the backs of my ears, and I don't know if I am living or I'm just living here, and I don't know to make it better, is that possible? And I don't know if I go harder, is that better?
So that was Ticking from Sprints. Possibly the first great new album of the year. Jamila, what do you think?
I was like, off the bat, the opening track, that track, yeah. I was, you know, I just, that's the kind of the one that, you know, always the first track that you play. I thought it was quite menacing. Oh. Like, it's quite dark and kind of spooky. And the spoken tone, like lyric style, that's quite sort of haunting. It's quite unsettling as the listener. But that's clearly the point of the style.
Yep.
But this, like, combined with that sort of droning undertone, dare I say, I wrote down it's kind of culty cool.
You mean cult like the band, or just like a cult?
Like a cult. I don't know why it came to me like that.
Right.
It kind of just feels like a bit sort of creepy, but in like a cool way.
Right. Well, I kind of wrote some notes. I said like heavy was kind of suffocating, but hallucinatory as well. There's all this stuff going on, and it just made me feel all these things while I was listening to it. So I don't know. Graham, yeah.
I'm just going to say this to you. I might like you better if we sleep together. I might like you better.
There is some Romeo Void there, yes, indeed.
When I first heard that track, I thought, wow, you know, she's got that whole repetition thing going, which is increasingly oppressive. And the lines, I can't sleep, I can't sleep, I can't sleep. Wow, this is serious stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I just interviewed Deborah Ayal from Romeo Void a couple of months ago. She has a new record out. It was nice to see that she's doing well, because you always wonder about people. But I had met her back in the day, and I wasn't that worried. But yeah, you're right. Romeo Void, classic band that is a touchstone for definitely this stuff here. I agree 100%. Andrea, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I like that there's that sort of staccato feel to it as well, so that there is that darker menace of the spoken lyrics that kind of go into shouting lyrics, and that building tension that comes from it. And it almost reminded me of like there's like a defensiveness, but an attacking at the same time, that also remind me of Amanda Palmer, that, you know, there's like this rising stakes,
right?
And both subtle and disturbing in some areas, and then really simple, direct and raw in others, but with this urgent beat that just kind of gets faster and more distorted and heavier for a lot of their songs, to a big crescendo at the end. Which, I mean, I really liked it. I think, you know, like it's this,
yeah. Yeah, yep, that's what they do.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there's such overtone.
Well, if you like that one, there's another song called Literary Mind, which I think I'll just play a bit of that to go out on, because, again, it's got this great bass line, and the band just rocks. I mean, the rest of the band, there's a guy named Colm O'Reilly on guitar, Jack Callen on drums, and the bass player is Sam McCann, and they sound like a real band. They don't sound like a bunch of people just thrown together and, you know, reading off a chart or something. they're playing together. So this is, and I love the words to this literary mind. Again, it's kind of Patti's heavy.
I feel the sun hot beating on my skin.
Before we wrap up this episode of Sound Thinking, since I've got you all here, I've been inundated with the work of Amanda Palmer. We mentioned her a little bit here. She just put out that EP of her New Zealand survival songs. She was here on Friday playing in my living room for hours, it seemed, because each song is like 8 minutes long, and she likes to talk. But so I'm just curious what your opinion of her is in general. You don't have to talk about the album or the EP specifically, but she's an artist who everybody, whether you want to or not, you kind of know what she's all about because she's so good at getting her message out. And I think I'll start with Jamila. What do you think of Amanda Palmer?
Honestly, I'm still like compiling thoughts. I like you say, Marty, like you can't, especially if you're like in the music industry in some capacity, you can't avoid knowing about, you know, what she's doing or who she is. I think she's really unique. And I think that the way that she tells stories and the lilting sort of tones that she has in her voice is so specific. Like you could hear it and be like, that's Amanda Palmer. You know, it's very unique to her. I had a quick listen to this recent sort of compilation, and it's interesting. This is sort of, I guess, not really music related at all, but there's a song, Whakanefa, which is a place on Waiheke, which is where I grew up. And to me, it kind of hit me a little bit differently, because there's not really often, especially in New Zealand, that a song is written about a place that you've been.
Right.
And especially a place that's so specific as this like campground / beach on Waiheke. And because of that, it kind of drew me in. And then listening to that, it kind of made me relate to what she was talking about in a different way, because I could like visualize extremely the scenario that she was speaking about. And I've had like the sort of song speaks about, I know it's quite, you know, undefined, but it sort of talks about like a wedding ring and, you know, she's clearly been wronged by somebody or something sort of like gone wrong. And I've witnessed a wedding at Whakanefa, and it kind of went wrong, not to be too personal. So it was kind of interesting.
Life imitating art.
yeah, exactly.
Andrew, what about you? Do you have some thoughts on Amanda?
Yeah, I do. Like in Whakanefa, there was this nostalgic piano. I couldn't really quite place what it reminded me of, but they had these soft minor notes, but these kind of really harsh messages. And there was like this poignance of the whole thing's turned to ash, and her son's named Ash. And that's, you know, the son she shares with
right.
Neil Raymond, who she's breaking up with at the time, that her marriage to Neil is ending. But you tried to cover it with Cash. Like this was sort of less relatable. Like in the pandemic, there were all these sort of rich celebrities decrying their pandemic isolation while on yachts and in mansions and things. But Palmer wasn't really guilty of that. She was locked down in a B&B in Havelock North, you know, for a lot of it. Though clearly Waiheke was a better choice. I thought it was really clever in a lot of ways. You know, the falling tree that no one hears but me is like, and it's like raw and blunt. And again, with really confessional elements, like there's things that she'd say that comes through as kind of vulgar and jarring in the middle of it and really personal. And I noticed, you know, when you were interviewing her, you were asking her about if she edits herself, and she sort of claims that she does, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what did she leave out? So, but yeah, it was really reflective, and some of it was really relatable about the pandemic and this like this homesick lament about living in New Zealand during the pandemic when she's kind of wanting New York, but also that understanding that New York is so dangerous and you know that doom scrolling stuff that isn't isn't sexy to write an album about, but is everybody, we all went through it. We all went through this. And again, that Sylvia Plath desperation of domesticity, like there's trauma and mental illness and sexuality and isolation, but she's talking about really mundane things, you know, like the ants getting into the maple syrup, like that stuff. But we know from having lived through the pandemic that when that stuff happens, like it's not just a trip to the dairy, you know, like it means more because of the pain and dislocation and isolation that you're in.
Graham, I know you have an interesting perspective on Amanda. You've tried to avoid her for years, you told me, I think.
No, not entirely true. No, there's certain people who interview opportunities came up with, and, you know, I was either busy or way late by doing something else. I mean, Lou Reed, I don't need that much in my life.
Actually, I met Lou once, and he was nice to me. But I was lucky.
The thing about Amanda Palmer is that that exquisite detail, as I just said, you know, exquisite detail in those songs, you know. That said, however, I am going to have to sort of beg off that one because I watched your excellent interview with her, Marty, and she spoke so articulately to you just in an interview and then prefaced the songs with such detail that by the time she was about to play, I was almost wrung out.
Right.
And I thought, I am not in the position to now listen to an 8-minute song having given all that information.
Yep.
Subsequently, I went back and listened to a couple of them and just thought, oh, now I get it. I actually don't need to hear the other bit because the detail is all there.
Yep.
So, you know, my feeling is that there's two things going on here. There's the subject who was interviewed, who's articulate, and da-da-da-da, and then there's the artist who transforms that into something else.
Right.
So I will pass on the first and head to the last.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, she was very insistent on it being presented as an entire thing. So that's what when I edited it all together, I put everything in there. But I have a feeling we'll chop it up into some bite-sized pieces. Yeah, Andrew?
I wondered if that, you know, like she did say a lot, and I think that it felt like she was reprocessing it or it was all coming up again because she'd come back to New Zealand. You know, like this was the place where she went through, you know, a lockdown, a marriage dissolution, and just that loneliness. And while her friends were all dying in New York, and I feel like it was a different pandemic for her here than it was for us. And coming back here, I would say, was quite triggering. You know, I think that talking about it was because it was kind of all bubbling up again and so much of it was so dark for her at the time, you know, and I think it was brave of her to come back even.
So I will say I spent a lot of time with her. Obviously she was up here with the crew and there was some other people around, and she seemed very genuine the whole time. She didn't come off like she was playing a part or doing this to promote the record, that kind of thing. And she, you know, she was going through serious emotions, and it was very intense interviewing her because she was like this far away from me. Yeah, I'm holding up my hands and staring me right in the eyes. And it was very, very, it was like, holy crap. But I have definitely plenty of respect for her after that. So anyway, So thank you guys for doing this first episode of Sound Thinking. It's been amazing. I've learned a lot just talking to you guys, and I hope everybody else who listens to this will have as well. And we'll do this every week. Just for a little bit of self-promotion, I'm going to play out some music that Amanda Palmer played here at the 13th floor, just because I can. And I hope to see you all, or at least some of you, next week on Sound Thinking.
They sell grade A Canadian maple syrup in New Zealand. It's expensive, but I splurge so I can put it on our pancake breakfast. And sometimes I forget to put the lid on and the ants come into the kitchen of this Airbnb we've been renting for 9 months for a fortune. And sometimes I take a magazine and I escort them 2x2 on a little glossy lifeboat to the garden. And sometimes I just create an ant holocaust and kill them all with a paper towel. I don't understand which part of me is kind. I don't understand which part of me can be so goddamn unkind. I don't understand why I can't make up my mind. All I know is that last night I had to go to bed by 5 o'clock. I took off my necklace and I turned up the heater.